So let me now turn to Dr. Stephanie Wilkinson, who will speak to us on small business sustainability in a stakeholder-driven future. She is an entrepreneur, a writer, and an activist. Dr. Wilkinson is co-founder and co-owner of The Red Hen, an award-winning farm-to-table restaurant in Lexington, Virginia. She has founded several other small businesses, including a retail fiber art store, a literary magazine nearing its second decade, and a downtown development organization. Her PhD is in European and American religious history from the University of Virginia. She earned a certificate of entrepreneurship from the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses program at Babson College. She's working on a book about the events surrounding the Red Hen's refusal to serve the White House press secretary in June 2018. The thousands of pieces of mail it generated and the national controversy it sparked. Her shorter writings, including op-eds in the Washington Post, are focused on the emerging trend toward social consciousness and political engagement among small businesses. Dr. Wilkinson.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'm really grateful to be included in this conference because it's such outstanding company. And I'm, by a considerable measure, one of the least credentialed and celebrated speakers. But I really hope that I can bring something worthy to the table. Back in 2019, when I first thought about what I might talk about in Envisioning a Better America conference, I thought I'd be speaking about a subject that had become very important to me as a small business owner who considers herself someone with a social conscience, someone who doesn't think there is or should be any natural wall between what you believe is right as a citizen of a nation that purports to uphold certain values and how you behave as the owner of a business. I had planned to talk, as Richard said, about how one private action I took in the summer of 2018, asking then White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders to consider dining elsewhere rather than in my tiny 26-seat restaurant, sparked a national discussion about how certain kinds of things are right or wrong, what are the lines between public and private conscience, and whether acts like mine were legitimate forms of resistance to an administration perpetuating outrageous and inhumane acts, like separating children from their parents at the southern border, or reinstituting discrimination against gay people serving in our military. I thought then that I would explore how small businesses can be forces for upholding the values we want to believe define our nation. So that's what I thought I was going to be talking about. But today I'm not. I guess I'm not the only speaker this week whose talk has changed from what it would have been 18 months ago. I guess most of us feel significantly transformed by the events of 2020 and 2021. It's been quite shocking to watch our country grapple with a pandemic, with police violence, racial reckoning, insurrection at the Capitol, and on and on. Shocking, disheartening, worrying, but for me also clarifying and galvanizing. So today, I'm still going to talk about small business and the role it can play in perpetuating the founder's vision of a nation of people created equal, endowed with rights, and dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm just doing it through a different angle, by illustrating the journey of one small town and one modest program for moving those ideals forward. So forgive me for this little bait and switch, but stick with me because I think it's going to be a good story. And now I'm going to try to share my screen. So thoughts and prayers, everyone. Okay, I'm hoping everybody can see it now. The town I've called home for close to 30 years, Lexington, Virginia, has a long and fraught history, particularly when it comes to the all men are created equal part of our nation's self-description. It's a small town, about 7,000 people these days, in the heart of the Shenandoah Valley that sits right at the crossroads of two of the longest routes in the U.S., Route 11 going north and south, starting at the Canadian border in New York and ending in New Orleans, and Route 60 that starts at Virginia Beach and ends in Brenda, Arizona. It's a lovely, lovely bucolic town. If you've heard of Lexington, though, it may be because it's the home of two old and venerated institutions of higher education, the Virginia Military Institute, the oldest state-supported military college in the U.S., and Washington and Lee University, which began as Augusta Academy in 1749 and, following a gift of stock from George Washington, became Washington College in 1796. Following the Civil War, as Richard said, the struggling university got a new lease on life when Robert E. Lee was appointed its president, prompting a rush of young men from the South to enroll. In gratitude, following Lee's death in 1870, the school added his name to its own. The universities, the town, and surrounding Rockbridge County, like other Southern communities, was built largely on the labor of enslaved Black people, and that fact has marked it ever since. The city has, over time, doubled and trebled down on its association with the Civil War, building much of its identity on being a tourist destination for people wanting to visit the universities and the graves of two of the most notable figures of the war, Robert E. Lee, buried in a crypt on the campus of Washington and Lee, and Thomas Stonewall Jackson, whose grave sits at the center of the Old Presbyterian Cemetery, which, decades after his death, at the height of Jim Crow and the promulgation of the Lost Cause narrative by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, was renamed Stonewall Jackson Memorial Cemetery. Streets, hotels, hospitals, and businesses all proudly borrowed the cachet of and named themselves after the men who fought to perpetuate a way of life built on slavery. But here's an interesting thing about Lexington following the Civil War and emancipation. While some formerly enslaved people moved away from the area, a large number stayed. And many of them turned their talents and the trades they'd previously performed for their white enslavers' benefit to open businesses of their own. As a matter of fact, by the early part of the 20th century, a whole swath of Main Street in Lexington was populated by Black-owned businesses. Tea houses, insurance companies, doctor's offices, restaurants, barbershops, dry goods, and more. Earlier this year, students at Washington and Lee University researched those businesses and put together an interactive map of those Black-owned businesses. And you can see, if you're looking at my screen, you can see on the left-hand side, all of those little gray squares are some of the businesses they investigated deeply. Here are just a few of them. There was a wonderful barbershop that lasted for years, 50 years, a pool room and a tea room. This is all part of the streetscape of North Main Street. Here's the offices of John Gilmore, who was a physician for years. He served the Black and the poor white community equally, but he was unable to have any hospital privileges at Stonewall Jackson Hospital, so he was never able to go into the hospital. He made house calls. Here's Washington Cafe and the Franklin Barbershop, today a quite a fancy restaurant. One of the most prominent and well-respected citizens in the Black community was Harry Lee Walker. He opened a butcher shop and a grocery store, which eventually became the premier supplier of meats to VMI and Washington and Lee. Harry, along with his philanthropically active wife, Eliza Bannister Walker, bought a beautiful Italianate mansion on one of the hills near the center of town, in what was then the center of the Black neighborhood. By the economic standards of the day, they had made it. But I do not mean to paint an overly rosy picture of race relations in Lexington. Folks living here today vividly recall the days when the Lyric movie theater restricted Black people to the balcony seats, when it was common for them to teach their children what parts of Rockbridge County they could and couldn't venture into after dark, or sometimes ever, and the times they weren't welcomed in white-owned downtown shops. Yet they also describe a tight-knit, proud, and thriving community with teachers, doctors, and plenty of business owners making a living for themselves and their families. Now, the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s changed that scene dramatically with some unintended negative consequences. The first thing that happened was the integration of the school system. Prior to the 1960s, Black children in Lexington up to high school age were educated at Lilburn Downing. The public school system didn't provide a high school for Black children, only whites, so Black parents had to find a way to privately educate their children beyond the eighth grade, or send them to another community, or send them out into the working world. And then, when the Lexington public schools integrated, the vast majority of the teachers at Lilburn Downing were not hired at the newly integrated school. I think I've heard that a couple were retained, but others, by all accounts, were just out of luck. With no work, the teachers and their families, by and large, upped stakes and left to places that were hiring Black teachers, like Baltimore or Washington. And that began a migration of the Black middle class out of the Rockbridge area. Without places and systems that they had some say in or control over, fewer and fewer young Black people considered Lexington a place for them. They grew up and left. Now, Black-owned businesses held on longer, but as young people left and the Black population declined, so did the percentage of Black-owned businesses. In the 1970s, Lexington's population of Black people was 30%, and today it is not quite 9%. Still, it wasn't until 2017 that the last Black-owned business owners sold shops they had opened and operated for close to 30 years, leaving us with zero. And here's a few of them. Here's my friend Tracy Lackey, who closed her shop in 2016. Here's Wendell's Barbershop, who he ran the shop for 50 years. He died about a year and a half ago. And here is Ernestine and Al Hockaday, who, again, for 30 years ran two shops right on Main Street, and they sold it. So from a whole swath of downtown, we ended up with none. And I'm going to pause here and kind of consider the impact of that loss, because it's not just the loss of a thriving business to the business owner's livelihood. This kind of a loss is a loss to the community at large and to all the young people coming up in Lexington. Over the last 50 years, our community has become whiter and more affluent, much less diverse. That means that the students in the universities who walk around downtown and the children who grow up here rarely, if ever, encounter a Black bank teller, a Black realtor, or a Black business owner. It distorts white youth's perceptions, possibly reinforcing prejudices about what Black people are capable of, and it leaves Black youth without a visual signal that there's a place for them in Lexington, now or in the future. So it's no wonder that they leave. Here's this same section of downtown that had been majority Black owned. And this is what it is today. It's not Black owned, not the businesses, not the buildings. Okay, let's fast forward to the spring of 2020, when our nation, or better said, the white members of our nation, were newly shaken into consciousness and outrage by the murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and others at the hands of white law enforcement and citizens. Lexington, like other communities around the country, took a hard look at itself. We held vigils, we marched in the streets, mounted protests, began writing our representatives, and saw a vast increase in political activism. This raised consciousness prompted some things to start to change. Led largely by the testimonies of our youth, who showed up in droves at our city council Zoom meetings, wrote letters, and launched social media persuasion campaigns, our city council finally voted to change the name of Stonewall Jackson Memorial Cemetery to Oak Grove Cemetery over the outraged protests by those who claimed it was the erasure of history. Businesses and not-for-profits examined themselves too. The Carilion Hospital chain changed the name of Stonewall Jackson Hospital to Carilion Rockbridge Community Hospital. The Robert E. Lee Hotel, which stands right in the center of Main Street, the tallest building in town, changed its name to the Gin Hotel. At Virginia Military Institute, the statue of Stonewall Jackson that all cadets formerly were required to salute when going in and out of the barracks was taken down and George Marshall moved into his place. As Richard noted, Washington and Lee has been undergoing a long and quite tempestuous reexamination of its own racial history, including a protracted debate over changing its name, which, by the way, it has not. Such changes were long overdue and the right thing to do. but clearly they're not enough. When Lexington's racial reconciliation groups came together to talk, one thing became clear. Our Black community members did not think that merely changing the names of a few landmarks would do much to change the viability of Lexington as a place for Black people to live and work. What was needed was a clear path to their own economic empowerment. In the midsummer of 2020, some friends and I decided to use whatever tools we could gather to try to address that problem head on. Since I'm a serial small business owner, my tool is entrepreneurship. I've started 3 small businesses myself, and during the 5 years I spent as the director of our Downtown Development Association, I helped numerous other businesses get started too. So I decided to try to repurpose a program I'd led in 2018 when I was executive director of Main Street Lexington, and to focus on a new program created by a new group directly on the creation, support, and funding of Black-owned businesses in Lexington and Rockbridge County. Back in 2018, that program was called Launch Lex. It was funded by a $60,000 grant from the state of Virginia with a $10,000 match from the city of Lexington. Its primary goal was to fill some empty storefronts downtown that would improve the look of our town, increase the tax base, and perhaps create some jobs and provide more things for locals and tourists to see and do and buy. The program's pretty simple. It invited people interested in starting a business to enroll in an 8-week business basics training course, then helped the aspiring entrepreneurs write business plans, and culminated in a community-wide showcase event, kind of like the TV show Shark Tank, if you've ever seen it, where a panel of judges listen to the business's pitches and select some to receive grant funding. Here's a picture of the class in 2018. And here's a picture of the winners holding their giant checks. So this is 2018, and you can see from these pictures who enrolled in that class and who won the money. The class was 99% white, and 100% of the winners were white. The program was deemed a huge success. Even though only 4 businesses were awarded grants, 8 businesses opened. And here's something really special. They're all still in business today, 3+ years later, and despite a pandemic, which, if you know anything about the failure rate of small businesses, is quite remarkable. Governor Ralph Northam was so impressed, he made a special trip to Lexington to tour these businesses and congratulate them on their opening. Now, I want to pause here and remark on the lessons we learned from Launch Lex, these observations that are crucial for the program I'm about to describe. One of the most important ingredients to small business success is community support. Starting a small business is a very lonely endeavor, and most people are just thrown into the deep end to sink or swim without meaningful support. 2, businesses that receive training are statistically much more likely to get over the initial stress of launch and keep their doors open. And 3, businesses that don't receive startup grants can still launch successfully, but they have to have the private means to do so. Banks do not like to lend to small business startups without some form of personal collateral. And when it comes to ownership of collateral or private means, the playing field in this country is nowhere near being level. Remember Harry Lee and Eliza Walker? Our group took them as our inspiration as we went about trying to put together a Launch Lex-like program to jumpstart Black-owned businesses in Lexington. And, you know, like all good programs, we made the logo first. Here it is, the Walker Entrepreneurship Program. We knew we were going to need 3 things: a board of willing volunteers to direct and support the program, the assistance of business training professionals, and the in-kind and monetary support donated by our community. Now, one huge advantage of living in a small town is that everyone is connected to everyone else by way fewer than 6 degrees of separation. If you don't know the person you need to connect to, someone you do does. So it didn't take us long at all to pitch the idea to community organizations and to put together a group of sponsors. These sponsors committed to supporting the program, for the most part with in-kind donations of their services, or perhaps lending a person to the board or the training program, or with their own funds. And some of them did all 3. And this is a representation of our sponsors. Then we tried to assemble a board that covers a diverse range of expertise, interests, and abilities. We have representatives from the Chamber of Commerce, the universities, current and former business owners, the Rotary Club, the NAACP, and our local progressivist activist organization, 50 Ways Rockbridge. Thanks to a law professor at WNL, we were also able to obtain the commitment of a Richmond-based law firm, Vinson & Elkins, who provides pro bono legal services to all of our entrepreneurs. Then we set about raising funds. Our initial goal was modest and modeled after the Launch Lex program. We figured we weren't in the running for any government grants necessarily, but we'd consider it a good start if, like Launch Lex, we came up with $60,000 or $70,000 for a grant fund to start 4 to 6 new businesses by the end of 2021. So $60,000, 4 to 6 businesses, end of 2021 seemed reasonable. Well, the community responded enthusiastically. Funds began coming in at the end of 2020. The proceeds of a downtown Christmas-themed 5K run were dedicated to the grant fund, as were the ticket sales of an online performance of A Christmas Carol. The churches in our community were particularly responsive. The youth group at the Lutheran Church voted to dedicate $7,500 of their church funds. The Methodist Church passed the collection plate one Sunday and added another $800. Lexington Presbyterian Church, where Stonewall Jackson famously taught Sunday school to enslaved children, dedicated $1,000. And Grace Episcopal Church, as Richard noted, which stands on the campus of Washington and Lee University, and which until 2017 was named Robert E. Lee Episcopal Church, or St. Bob's, in a conscious act of reparations, gave a whopping $25,000 to the cause. Individuals gave from our community at all levels, the smallest being a $5 donation, and the largest was an anonymous gift of stock that ended up being valued at more than $50,000. We aimed for $60,000 and we received $165,000. Of course, we had no idea how many people in our Black community would put themselves out there to try an untested program like this. We ran articles in the paper, we advertised at our local drive-in theater, we sent flyers to the churches, and of course, we flooded Facebook with news. We set up a simple online application. Within 5 weeks, we had 14 applicants. Of course, we're still in the first wave of COVID, so we had the added complication of not being able to conduct the business training in person. But that turned out not to be such a bad thing. After polling the participants, we decided to hold classes for 2 hours every Monday evening on Zoom, beginning in January of 2021 and ending in early March. Most of our entrepreneurs also had day jobs, so this was a convenient time. And the instructors we recruited to share their expertise, like marketing professors from the universities, banking professionals, small business coaches, accountants, and the like, were more than happy to lend a couple of their evening hours. We also have the added advantage of living in a very rich educational environment. In addition to Washington and Lee and VMI, we have Southern Virginia University 6 miles to our east. We arranged with marketing professors at WNL and SVU to create student groups assigned to each aspiring business to perform research, brainstorm marketing techniques, tutor them on social media, come up with logo ideas, and carry out other startup projects as needed. And here you see one of our entrepreneurs, Leonard Stewart, meeting with some WNL students and me. By April of this year, 5 of our entrepreneurs were ready to submit completed business plans to the board. And that's when the board decided to make one big change from the competitive Shark Tank model of Launch Lex. We knew we had such a generous pot of money, and we decided it didn't make sense to make the participants in the Walker program vie against one another. Instead, we were going to be committed to vetting each plan for its own self, for its own viability. We wanted to ensure the business owner understood the market, had a clear idea of their product and service, knew the basics of break-even analysis and how to reach their customers. And then when that bar was crossed, we would commit to providing them with meaningful grants to get started. And I want to say a word about the importance of grants in this context. This money was never intended as a loan, never meant to be repaid. This money takes the place of the kind of resources and assets that some people are in a position to leverage for a startup, but many, many do not have access to. Many people start businesses by tapping their credit cards. They remortgage their house, they sell an asset, they borrow from friends, their parents leave them a small legacy. If you look at these graphs, they all say pretty much the same thing. Starting a business supposes you have a certain net worth or access to a network of people who do. But now we know, thanks to recent studies from the Brookings Institution, that that net worth in our country is tremendously racially skewed. So this is a graph that we use quite frequently. The average white American family's net worth is 10 times a Black family's. 10 times. Recent examinations of the pattern of lending to Black entrepreneurs also shows up troubling disparities, as this graphic shows. In one study, less than a third of Black business owners received bank funding compared to two-thirds of white business owners, despite having the same household income. So it's no wonder that it's much harder to bootstrap a business if you're Black. For that reason, the Walker Board decided it was not going to structure these startup funds as loans, but as grants. This money donated by our community stands in for the wealth Black families were prevented from acquiring owing to structural discrimination like redlining, which prevented Black people from accumulating wealth through home ownership, which could then be leveraged into something like a small business, or the GI Bill, which largely locked out Black veterans from the benefits that fueled the rise of the well-off white middle class in the second half of the 20th century. So, back to our first round of business plans. After much discussion and vetting, we deemed four of the five plans ready to go, and we awarded grants ranging from $10,000 to $25,000. In addition, we kept the support going. We helped them find locations, helped with legal documents required to start and register a business, assisted in negotiating leases, and procured donations of fittings and equipment. And I want to introduce you to our new entrepreneurs. Chandi Stewart is a 22-year-old photographer. She actually graduated from high school, Rockbridge County High School, with my daughter. And she has been taking pictures since she was a child. She has started a small business out of her home, taking pictures of people in the outdoors. She has now received a grant that is enabling her to open a storefront on Washington Street, where not only will she be able to demonstrate her beautiful photography, but she'll be able to have an indoor studio for people who want photo shoots and when the weather is not great. Here's Justina Eason. Justina's always wanted to have something related to parties and making people happy. She's created a balloon studio. She creates balloon bouquets that can be delivered to a loved one. She creates those beautiful arches for parties and columns. And she's also able to do this amazing thing with clear balloons that have items inside them, like a teddy bear or a bottle of champagne or something. It's a very in-demand business. Here's Leonard Stewart, who you saw a little bit earlier. And his passion is making things clean. He takes things like the car you see on the left, which looks like a disaster, and makes it beautiful again. His tagline is, we want to help you love your car again. He used his grant to buy a trailer and kit it out with all the equipment he needs to bring the mobile detailing to you. And his business is in huge demand. Finally, we have Allison. Allison is a stylist, an accomplished stylist who has started a hair salon, nail salon, beauty salon in Lexington called Inspired to Enhance. And this one is special for sort of a great reason. Allison's business has opened up in the very location that Wendell's Barbershop was in for 50 years. She worked with the landlord. She repurposed the space. You can see it in that picture down below. And this one was so special to our community that we had between 75 and 100 people come out for her ribbon cutting. A majority of the Black population was represented. She was just so thrilled, and the community was so thrilled to see this happen again. So I just want to say that we are really, this is the first four. We've accomplished already our goal of four in 2021, but we are not nowhere near done. We had so many people who heard about the first round of training. Again, it's a small town and word of mouth travels fast. We already launched a second round of training in July. That 8-week training course had 9 participants and finished on September 1st. And this week, this Wednesday, the Walker Board met to consider 5 brand new business plans. And today at 4 o'clock, we will meet again to finalize their grant awards. So we expect four or five more businesses to come out of this. On the table are plans for a tow truck business, a holistic healthcare business, a pastry cafe inside our public library, a Black-oriented skin, hair, and beauty supply store, and a headstone engraving and maintenance business. We're also expecting to see other plans coming out of that class in the future months because we don't really put a time limit on when people can submit their business plans, including a soul food cafe, a skincare product line, and a daycare, something our community is desperately short of. We are so heartened by the community's support and by the eagerness with which the program is taking off. As of today, we have more than enough people interested to fill yet a third round of training, and we still have money in the kitty to get them started. We'd love to help other communities replicate this program. To that end, a student at Washington and Lee took it upon herself this spring to center her capstone project around creating a Walker program handbook. This 17-page booklet outlines our program, describes the steps we took to get it started, and provides some pointers on how other communities might carry out a similar one. I just have to end by saying that the prompt of visioning a better America is such a rich place to start a conversation. And I really thank Richard for giving us this opportunity to reflect on where we want to go. I hope that you can see from our small example that moving beyond vision to implementation on a local level can happen and in relatively short order. I think we've made real progress towards the better Lexington we envisioned just a year ago. We know the bettering is much more than just some new businesses and new employment opportunities. Releasing the suppressed potential of Black entrepreneurs is a big change, and it will, we trust, change the attitudes in our whole community. It's a step towards becoming that more perfect union we all so fervently desire. Thank you.